A Simcar 5, a faster horse. Horace, continuing our effort to understand what is happening to the auto ecosystem, let's step back in time and revisit the raison d'etre for horseless carriages or cars and review what's changed over the years. Henry Ford was born 150 years ago this year, and the statement is often attributed to him, although apparently incorrectly, that if I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. So why did horseless carriages evolve? What were the jobs they were hired to complete in those early years?
You know, what's funny is I was at a museum this summer in Brussels, and actually we used a photo from that museum once for our post. And I went. There was a section. This was a museum about cars. It was Auto World, I think. It was something like that. That was the name of it. But they had a section in there which was dedicated to carriages, horse-drawn carriages. You know, they had near it as well a section devoted to royal family, because the Belgians have a royal family, their vehicles, including, you know, obviously the carriage pulled by horses. And so you have a very, you know, that's the picture we have in our minds of the elaborately decorated Cinderella type, you know, carriage. But for obviously hundreds of years in urban and exurban areas, these were the primary modes of transport. Apart from riding, and riding was a specialization that few people were trained to do, I believe, because riding is also inefficient. You're tending to be the only person that the horse serving, the horse is serving. So what struck me though about the horse carriages is the names they had for them, which were very much the names that we ended up using in cars. So, for example, phaeton, the coupe, Americans would say coupe.
Right.
Try to remember some of the others, but it'll be worthwhile going through those and you know, even sedan, I think, actually was the name of a carriage type, and these types where invented, if you will, for jobs to be done. I mean, they were just as we have today the need for you know, sports car versus, you know, family car, or something even called, I think, a shooting brake, which is a type of carriage used for going hunting, and so they were. All of those names were picked up by the car makers because it was a comfortable categorization of vehicle types.
Sure, consumers understood the term, right?
Right, and I think it also probably had along with it a cachet, a certain
market segmentation.
Yeah, but people would probably associate the luxury brands of those kinds of vehicles, you know. And the other thing that's interesting, by the way, with cars is how compliant they are with the road systems predating cars and with the conventions of left and right side of the street driving. The width of the car and the dimensions of the vehicle were pretty much set in stone, literally by the Romans, because they had built these roads around Europe, which all led to Rome. Certainly, indeed, did lead to Rome. But they were basically defined for a certain size vehicle or single horse. But they fit, you know, a lot of these dimensions. And also, it went on to be defining railroads to some degree as well. The idea, for example, of which side of the road to drive on has been. The British, one thing, by the way, I think the British system is more clever about is that it makes sense if two horses are passing each other, men can shake hands, right? Riders, I should say, can shake hands, their right hands, if they're passing each other on the British system. But not so much on the other side.
Right, although I think the dirty hand. Yeah.
If you're jousting, though, you want to be doing it by driving on the right, because you're going to try to hold with the right hand the lance. And so if you're actually competing in a joust, you want to go the other way. But if you're actually friendly with the other rider, you want to go the other way. So I think they had to work this out back when the roads were for horses only. But that's so. Given all that, right? So think about it as not just starting in Henry Ford's time, but going way back. That transportation systems were a matter of public debate for many, many centuries, and the questions around passage right of way, questions about whether there should be tolls on roads, questions about whether you should police roads because there would be highwaymen existed before we have cars, because they were literally thieves that would rob you on the highway, and that's the famous Robin Hood was really based on that, on the legend of it was based on a highwayman. So a lot of things were going on as far as transportation before the car. In fact, the car, as we know it, was compliant with everything that came before it.
With all of those norms. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there wasn't a breaking with a new network didn't have to be designed. The network was the road system already. Of course, it had to be expanded. It had to be re-engineered, but it had already existed in a way. You know, you still had to have bridges. You still had to have tolls and ferries and everything else. And you can see how in the nomenclature of vehicles, how also they carried forward the same segmentation and many other things about it. But Henry Ford, and of course he wasn't the first to come up with a car. 1880, if I'm correct, is 86 that Benz made or patented. I think that the historians will argue about who invented what when, but as far as the law is concerned, that's where we define the invention, the moment of sort of pioneering invention, and that is when the patent. So the patent for the Motorwagen was held by Benz first, and for aircraft it was by the Wright brothers, which is why we credit them. Although not everybody agrees that they flew first, and not everybody agrees that the Benz was the first car, but that's. So it took already from 83 till Model T was what, 12? I don't even remember.
The teens, yeah.
Yeah. So it took quite many decades before there was a mass market for cars. And the thing that makes Henry Ford famous is the production system that he developed that allowed cars to be mass-produced in such quantity, which was a complicated and a very technologically advanced product. However, again, having 30 years having gone by, it was already getting to the point where it was possible to reduce it in cost and in its complexity to some degree, and he cut a lot of corners to make it possible to get that car built in the quantity that
he
did.
And he failed a few times too, of course.
Yes. And then, of course, that's why it's not Model Model A.
Right. Which came later, but...
Yeah, but that's another problem. Story.
So, you know, thinking about that, I guess, sustaining approach early on in the car business, you know, what were the early jobs to be done that built it, and maybe it did take the cost reductions and the volume to bring that about.
That's the other thing is the earliest jobs, which were again with Benz and the Europeans were targeted, were actually high end jobs, and I think that's the or
Tesla.
We consider luxury.
Right?
Yeah, that's exactly what probably Tesla is trying to do, and so you had this was a hobby for rich men. This was to be the. You know, that's why they took up racing. It was something playboys did to impress women, presumably. It was just as a way people today think of having a Tesla. It's a status symbol, and it's proving your credentials as an avant-garde person. And so that was going on, but that's why we also had, you know, the brass era. There were a lot of these devices or these cars made with expensive components and handcrafted. They were technologically really quite advanced. We had Bugatti and some innovators who were really in creating super high performance vehicles for their time, being completely famous. Stories about Bugatti were how he was so obsessive, just like, you know, Steve Jobs would be about making a absolutely pristinely designed product with engineered to perfection and using the absolute best of everything. And that was, again, in the, you know, early part of the 20th century, very early. And he would, of course, the thoroughbreds he created would be tested in racing. And so everyone who did own cars would probably want to also improve their social standing by racing the vehicles and again showing off their skills and of course their wealth in doing so. And in fact, Mercedes began as a brand because a man who was a dealer of Benz cars. The dealer was a man, I think, by the name of Jelinek or Jelicek, and he had a daughter named Mercedes. And it was fashionable to name your car just like you have boats are named, right? Sure. You have a boat and you give it a name. And typically, it was in Europe at least, very, most commonly, it's a woman's name. And so it was Mercedes was the name he put on his car to honor his daughter, but also because it was necessary to put a woman's name on your car, and he, you know, by taking the Benz cars and he would race them, and he would being a dealer, he had wealthy friends who to whom he sold these cars, and by racing the Mercedes Benz, he could impress people about its performance and sell more cars. And so even though he was selling only in the dozens of units, he was actually influential enough that he would direct the factory into how to design the car. He would tell them, look, it needs more of this and more of that. And the story goes that the Mercedes-Benz, one of the stipulations he made is said, listen, you don't have a good name. If you put Mercedes on your cars, it will actually sell better because that's the name that is now winning in the races and so on. And so he convinced them to make certain design changes and to change the name because they were just a bunch of engineers. He was the marketing guy. And the marketing guy was already taking control over the product direction and leading the poor engineers into this marketing gimmickry. But it worked out because, in fact, the collaboration between these two went on to establish the company. And without those orders, there were many, many startups that failed in those years. Now, so what's different is that into the steps, the Model T. Now, Henry Ford was a flawed character in many ways, as most great men are. But the interesting thing about him is that he had this very down-to-earth American narrative that he brought to the automobile. And the European narrative was very much a class-based system. This was about the high end. And he said, you know, cars are for everybody. So he had this ethos of bringing it to everyone and saying down-to-earth, common sense, low price. You know, he was more, I would say, not Steve Jobs. He was more Jeff Bezos. You know, he was like trying to trying to cut as much out of the specification
supply
to bring
chain,
it
the whole
yeah.
thing and drive the cost.
And of course, he vertically integrated. That is more Jobsian. But but then again, vertical integration is not an invention from that era either.
But it was predates. Probably the only way to achieve his goal then, right?
I mean, yeah, there's so many tricks, and it wasn't a one-time thing. Throughout the years that the Model T was in production, they continuously re-engineered it and made it more refined. Now, one thing about the job to be done, though, is that he not only made the car cheap, but he also promoted and marketed the vehicle against non-consumption, and it was about saying to people who have modest means, and not, at the time, let's not forget the United States was not an urban society. It was a hugely agrarian, rural population. And many of those folks, so if you were to ask at the time, okay, I need a car to reach the mass market, and you would segment the market, you would realize that, let's say, 70% of your target audience is actually living on a farm somewhere. You know, at the same time, we had, for example, Sears and Roebuck, that also sold through catalogs to the same audience. And so if you wanted to be in the mass market, you better figure out how to sell to farmers. That was the primary question. And so he made the vehicle have these tremendously high off-road, or the axles were high enough, and the vehicle was tall, that it would handle all the ruts of driving off-road.
Roads, right.
Yeah, it probably has better off-road capability than most off-roaders have today.
Right.
So there was very much an emphasis. And also, I remember seeing films where he showed how the engine could be uncoupled from the drive shaft, and you could use it to power various farm equipment. You could use it to, you know, bale hay. You could use it to thresh your
wheat. Right.
Wheat. And then he had it set up so it could be a welder. It could be a with belt fed, you know, machinery. It could be a grinder. It could be a sawmill. And so he there was literally this kind of multitasking, multi-purpose vehicle, that the engine was as valuable as the car, that it had off-road capability. There were very few roads. And in that sense, it was brilliant, because those customers, again, created the critical mass that allowed the company to grow and grow. And so to speak, as the initial job was the foothold market, created the foothold market, then it created the demand for roads, which then created more urbanization and suburbans. And so one interesting thing about history of roads is, when you look at the effort of marketers and the effort of pioneers and entrepreneurs, yes, and con men and all kinds of other. But one thing that, for example, is, did you know that Miami Beach itself was created because some entrepreneur thought that now with cars, people are going to want to go to vacation somewhere south, especially if the population centers were, the industrial centers were in the north, they would want to travel south, and with cars, it was more, you could actually, here's the way to put it. Trains existed, but trains went to wherever the track went, and the track went to where a city
urban
was
areas,
already
right.
there. So if you wanted to develop real estate, think of this concept we have in mind. How do you develop real estate? You take a piece of land which is completely wasteland, unused, unwanted, and you make it into something that's a destination where people either live or visit, and it makes money just from nothing.
That
right?
transformation, right.
You transform, exactly, you transform
Many
the land.
Many parts of Florida have those stories, definitely. New Yorkers and New Jersey folks and New Englanders coming down, buying up land, and they're the sons and daughters of those families becoming very wealthy as that land developed over the years.
But it was actually one man's idea, and I saw a documentary of this. I think it was Nova, American, some American documentary. We'll look it up and we'll put it up as a note. But this man had initially, he was a pioneer who had developed Indianapolis 500 as a business. You know, he developed that racetrack and developed racing as a way of selling cars. Then he developed Miami. He said we need, and in order to develop Miami, you had to build a road from Chicago to get there, and it was just an amazing phenomenon that this is very American, right? That you just create something out of nothing.
Sure.
And indeed, because people had cars, it created all these interesting opportunities. I think real estate development is one of them, that with cars and with transportation, that you could go to places where there was nothing. And you wouldn't have thought of doing that in the 19th century and saying, well, you would maybe lay a track as they did between the East and the West Coast, and every point in between would need a station, and therefore the cities would grow up.
Lots of politics to do it, and bribes, yeah, and everything else. Yes.
But unless there was a natural resource that you wanted to target, like gold or farming,
oh, right?
But for leisure and to create a real estate destination for vacation, that's the story of Miami and Miami Beach, actually.
So it sounds like the job to be done of both the early European cars, the upper class cars, let's say, and then Henry Ford's car for the masses, was lifestyle, in that for the upper class it served as a social tool, as a sporting tool, as a romantic tool, maybe. And then as it emerged in the States with Henry Ford as a volume car, the jobs to be done were, again, lifestyle, but they were to make the agrarian population either more productive or make their life better or help them with their day-to-day work and yet conform to the system we had, which was mud roads and gravel and all these things. And so it sounds like we're starting to see a little bit of a transition from, let's say, social aspects of automotive ecosystem to lots and lots of jobs to be done. I mean, I think about the milk truck that my grandfather drove and all these things, you know, over the years. So can you think a bit about the next step, you know, what really made the car then rocket? And we saw a lot of companies emerge in this assembly line model and grow. What were the next set of jobs to be done?
Well, what happened so the Model T was a dominant force in the U.S. industry, in the U.S. auto industry. It really was hard to describe just how influential and how dominant the position was. And General Motors, which was actually it was the merger between many
right,
smaller
right,
companies.
Big roll-up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it has such a generic name, because literally it was Oldsmobile and Pontiac and all these other guys who couldn't stand on their own, essentially consolidated into one, and they decided to keep the brands, and then they carefully made sure that they didn't overlap in their positioning.
Market
and
segmentation.
That, yeah, so they created this segmentation logic. But the problem with General Motors was that literally it was just a conglomerate of multiple car companies and brands, but also each one had to have its own production facilities, right? So there wasn't any economy of scale, because they didn't know yet how to build off of a platform. So the first innovations at General Motors, where they leapfrogged Ford in the
right.
sense that they devised, first they targeted Ford with Chevrolet. They said, okay, that's going to be our mainstream brand, and in order for us to beat them, we're going to create product turns faster, make new models not every decade as Henry Ford was. In fact, he was stuck with the Model T. He couldn't get out of, in order for him to change over to a new model, he would have to shut down the factory.
And the supply chain.
Yeah. It was, the integration was important to get it's like building a great pipeline, but you can't divert, you can't change anything about it. It's set in stone. And so what General Motors did was invent a method of changing that pipe every few months. Well, maybe it was like at first.
The annual model changeover, right? And they really, maybe in a rough way or a crude way, were perhaps the first to look at modularization, right? Because they had a Fisher Bodyworks division, they had a chassis division, they had more an assembly division supplying the different brands, essentially.
Right, and so they modularized, they engineered. When you change a basic thing, like you want to get a new product out every year, and you want to segment, and you want to create choice in this is such a fundamental thing when you think about from the manufacturing point of view that this required them to change the way they engineer cars, change the way they build cars, change the way they sell cars, change the way they market them, which would be how to position them. And all of that innovation was taking place inside General Motors. They were solving this problem. And so to go from mass manufacturing, right, assembly line, continuous flow.
Same product, yeah, over and over and over, right.
To switch that to doing the same volume or even higher and be flexible at the same time. This was rocket science and brain surgery at the same time. It is really, you can't understate how important it was, how difficult it was, and actually that ability is what served the United States very well in World War II.
World War II, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Henry Ford was still alive, was watching this, but you know, he understood that, but it caused him to almost lost the company. They had to essentially catch up to GM in the 30s. And of course, we had all other factors, obviously the war, but he had the terrible depression. But to me, the story there is a story of manufacturing. And so first, the story of cars is engineering. Then people realize that you need to work out sales. Then people realize you need to work out the psychology of ownership and all that. And then you have to work out manufacturing in massive scale. And then you have to work out flexible manufacturing and all of the marketing tricks that go along with that. And so it's a great story. So the thing is how we take a history and we look at it as flipping a switch, but it's a very long process, very gradual, to go from horseless to the modern vehicles, the car industry. It took decades. It literally, you know, probably half a century for that to happen. And I think that's relevant to us today because, again, in the technology spheres, we do have a tendency to think it's a binary flipping of a switch. And it is. It actually takes
a lot of blood in the floor for that. But there are interesting analogies, I think. You know, you talk about the road system, the crude road system, and you know, one can recall when the first iPhone was introduced, the criticism of a 2G model, right? And then the 3G came, and you know, so the networks, maybe that explains a lot of what's happening, you know, in the smartphone space, where you've got the operators with such market power because of their both political, regulatory, and network control. And
it would be great to,
might be interesting.
It would be really worthwhile to study the how roads were built in the U.S. or globally. How did decisions about road building take place, and how much of that depended on the railroads, the laws related to the rail, and hence also later on to telegraph, and who owns the land where a road, you know, needs to be built? Who, you know, you had to devise all kinds of schemes which might seem to contradict basic tenets of private property, and you had the right to appropriate land, you had the right by the government to dictate right of way or whatever the terms were, and so indeed when you think about cellular networks or even wired networks, and you have the same laws being invoked that it's for the good of all that we have a network of roads, a network of cables, and whenever you get that type of debate going, it becomes highly politicized, obviously, because it all goes down.
Winners and losers immediately.
There's winners and losers. There's the ability of government to push its weight around, and so I think it's a topic of great. It would be a wonderful discussion to have. I'm reading a book, by the way, that I actually found online. It's called The Rise and Fall of Infrastructures, and it's a bit heavy in more mathematics and theory than one would hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is it's showing how important the importance of the network effects, the importance of the you know, and it goes all the way to canals, by the way. It's not even just roads. It's the fact that the first network for transportation were roads in the Roman period, but canals and viaducts were about the same time, where people had to work out how to get water moved from point
sure,
A to point
or large goods, you know, grain and coal and all that.
Yeah. So, you know, a famous story, I love this story about infrastructure, is like New York City depended on for most of 18th, 19th century, was that its power came from the fact that the Erie Canal was built, which had very far from New York, but that canal allowed produce and farm output to be shipped from the Midwest out to the Atlantic and hence worldwide. And the way you would get goods transported from farms to ships without roads in those years, it was about building you had the Great Lakes, but then to extend that to the Hudson River was through a canal, and the Hudson River would then lead to New York, which was essentially the Hong Kong of the day, which meant that you stuff got put on ships and got taken off ships, and you could get a little cut when you do that.
Right.
And that made it a huge metropolis. And if it wasn't for the Erie Canal, New York would not have been half of what it is. So canals actually were predating, and there were infrastructure projects that required a lot of investment. There were a lot of ventures built on the premise of investing in canals, also in Britain. And of course, there's the Suez Canal, which was a similar. That was a French effort, but it was a success story for the French, but then they tried to do the same thing in Panama, and they went bust.
Right,
a lot of people lost a lot of money there,
and lives, and lots of other things.
Yeah.
So the transition from these jobs to be done, and then the market segmentation again back to more of a social approach to the cars again has interesting parallels with what we're seeing today in the technology space. But you know, you wonder if technology today is more constrained by the operator networks compared to the roads in the past. You know, I remember back in the mid-2000s, there were always a couple startups with Wi-Fi-only phones or Wi-Fi-only devices, right? But they just never really caught on because, of course, Wi-Fi is limited, you know, and Intel has had various schemes for different networks. But so maybe that network effect is super powerful today and maybe constrains
I think,
what we can do.
But the reason I think Wi-Fi hasn't taken off or alternative sort of free networks is because these things actually take a lot of cost. It takes a lot of money to keep a network running.
Right.
If there's no profit motive.
But think about the difference with the road system evolution in the car era. You know, you have, at least in the States, you have local roads, you have county roads, you have city roads, you have state-maintained roads, you have federal roads, you have the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System. So there's a variety of players where in the operator space, you know, I mean,
well,
in the States, we may have four.
Yeah,
if we're lucky.
States, yeah. So exactly. Governments were instrumental in the building of the road networks.
Right.
And that also was because of lessons learned in the railroad era. In the initial rail era, railroads were private entities and tracks themselves, but the government had to protect them and offer them the right of way, and therefore had to be involved. Giving a concession to these guys, but it's a long history. I'm not fully prepared to dive into it, but you see how these never were truly market mechanisms at work. You had to be regulated because you're dealing with land, and land is never really in the public domain. Even federal land is not really. Governments own it, and there are constraints on what they can do with it. So there's always the problem with generally with infrastructure is that it is fundamentally it's a real estate. It's a public thing. It's shared. It's either shared or it's owned by somebody who needs to give rights to someone who wants to do something with it. And that fundamentally is a limited resource. You cannot expand it indefinitely and architect it any way you want.
But think about the entrance back then. You know, so if you're Alfred Sloan and you're thinking about the market segmentation at General Motors and you're thinking about Oldsmobile or Cadillac, at that time you could introduce the car, much fewer regulations, and you didn't have to cut a deal with the operator, right? Or you couldn't say, well, if you have a Cadillac car, you only can use the Cadillac roads, or maybe it's a Chevrolet and you can use the Chevrolet roads. It's not, we didn't lock those cars to a certain network.
Yeah, because there were standards.
Huge
there difference. Certainly there were standards in terms of what the network, the standard roads. There were rules and enforcement of rules. Because it was built again on the foundations or lessons learned of a previous era, which were railroads, and railroads learned from canals, and canals also learned from the more rudimentary roads that came before them. So laws and conventions date very far into history, and so that's why. It's hard to say that it's transplantable, that model can be easily transcribed into a modern era in a new technology domain. There are some serious issues about the role of government, the role of regulations, that's why I think telecom is fundamentally difficult to perceive by somebody coming from a computing background, because computers have grown up to be essentially unbounded by regulation, by rules, and the government involved in them.
Sure, so space, all these things. Maybe we can step back a bit and think about other aspects of the ecosystem. And one of the topics you had mentioned recently was insurance.
Well, you know, the reason I thought about insurance is because when it's one of the, it's how many times have you heard that, you know, we would have liked to do this crazy idea, but we couldn't get insurance.
Let's define insurance first, right? I mean, what's your definition? Let's talk about.
So I'm speaking specifically when you are trying to develop a new technology, but you realize that it depends on insurance because something can go wrong. So mostly this applies to transportation, obviously. But whenever there's a downside risk, people want to have insurance, no matter what. I mean, even computers, we insure them through antivirus. We insure them through backup systems that we may not use, and of course, warranties and things like that.
Well, here I'll throw a definition out. I looked around. It's one says coverage by contract, whereby one party undertakes to indemnify or guarantee another against loss by a specified contingency or peril. Quite broad, but that seems like
right. And that's the technical definition. What I'm saying, though, is conceptually, what I struggle with is this idea that in the absence of an insurance. Now, And the insurance is like, insurance business is like, is an odds making business. It's like bookies, you know, laying bets. And the only value for a particular policy depends on statistically, what are the odds of that happening? And an insurance company doesn't really make money, by sort of making a bet against, something. They essentially pay out as much as they get in, except they make a little margin in between. So they're never going to try. They'll try to be balancing these two, the risks, as much as possible. Actually, sometimes they make no money at all. They perfectly balance what they pay and what they receive, but they make money on the float because they get the money first and then they pay it out later. So they're actually more like they just have, it's an interest-bearing account. You give your money to them, and they earn the interest before paying it out to somebody else at some other point. So I think that the insurance fundamentally is about assessing risk and making sure that that the community that participates is
pulling their risk
exactly. Mm-hmm. So the reason why you may not get insurance for something crazy is because they haven't figured out how to assess risk for it.
Sure, or to lay it off to somebody else, right? That's often
right,
what they
because,
do, they reinsure. Yeah.
So, but fundamentally, that means they haven't had a sample of failures upon which to base the odds or the probabilities, and they don't know what the downside might be. And so because they haven't been able to put together sufficient data set, I mean, normally a bookie will you know, allow betting to happen on anything, right? They'll just, they don't set the odds. The odds are set by whoever puts the bets on. And so, but if you don't have a group of people and therefore a sample size, you can't get the odds. And that's what the problem with the insurance is in general, is that when you get him. Now, here's my. This is why the reason I brought it up is because I remember when I was young, I had one car, and then I wanted to get a second car, and I was young enough and foolish to think that it wouldn't cost me much more to get a second car because I was only one driver, right. And that's when I learned that actually you don't insure drivers, you insure cars, and that was very difficult for me to understand because the logic of it then is that the policy is on the vehicle, even though the policy covers the behavior of the driver, and your premium goes up if you're a bad driver, right? So it and supposedly if you have 100 cars, you could use them each as a weapon and destroy a lot of property, including your own, and therefore you should pay 100 times more. And what puzzles me, the reason I bring this up again, is that if we go to a different ownership model for cars, if we go to a different business model for transportation, what happens to the insurance? Who pays for all the times that things will go wrong with cars? So this was actually prompted, you know, if I'm remembering now, it was prompted by an article I was sent that asked these questions about the ethics of driverless cars. If you get into an accident and it was a computer that's driving.
Oh, right. That was in the Atlantic, yeah.
Yeah, in the Atlantic, exactly.
Yep.
Who's liable? Do you insure algorithms? Because now you insure the car again. So, but what if you're not the driver? And do you insure? Or what is likely to happen is that actually somebody will sue the programmer, or in the case of ownership of that program, they'll sue Google. So if a Google powered car causes, you know, a death, then is Google liable? for that, or even
the
personally,
bug in their algorithm, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe Google outsource some of the algorithm, and then do they pass off the liability? How do they indemnify algorithms? All of these things come into play. And the reason, again, stepping back even further, there was an industry that was killed, a transportation industry that was nearly killed by insurance issues, and that was the private aircraft industry. Private aircraft were an interesting opportunity, right? Maybe 50s and 60s, people were dreaming of, you know, cheap Cessnas in the hands of millions. And a lot of people learned to fly back then. And
sure, we have a subdivision north of Madison that was built with a runway in the middle of the houses. Yeah,
and there's a famous town somewhere in Florida that's actually, you can drive your plane right into your garage. And,
same idea.
And, yeah. I think actually, what is that actor from who owns a 707?
yeah, I don't follow Hollywood much, but I think
well,
I
there's
that.
A
anyway,
there's
there is a guy who flies around quite a bit. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. There's a guy who's a fan of aviation, right. And so he bought himself a 707. He can actually fly it, and you know, normally you would have a gate that clamps on, you know, the jetway. Well,
right.
His jetway goes right into his house.
Right.
I think that's really cool. That's kind of like out of a James Bond movie. You can find it on Google Earth. You can actually. I remember looking at this town, and it's you know, there was a 707 parked next to someone's house. Travolta, John Travolta.
There you go. Right.
Yeah. So this would have been a wonderful dream. There's your flying car. Just make, you know, every make an airport built into the middle of every town, and we're good to go with that idea. So what happened was, of course, somebody crashed, or some people crashed, and they began to sue the aircraft company.
Right.
So if there was a mechanical failure in the plane, and so pretty much the whole industry died. And it's not the only reason. Obviously, building the infrastructure is a major deal killer. But literally, these aircraft makers had to nearly shut down, and many of them actually did expire. And this is why there's been hardly any innovation happening in private aviation. I mean, there's obviously some, but it's exotic. And
it's $2 million planes, right?
Yeah, it's mostly for the true. It's like the car business in the 19th century, right?
Yes.
So. Still, after 60 years of the technology being with us, it hasn't created opportunity much. The point, though, is that insurance, and through the litigation process, meant that premiums for being your own pilot were astronomical. And so this is where I ask myself, could insurance be one of these culprits, one of these co-conspirators against innovation in transportation
cars,
technology?
Right.
Transportation technology has many opponents, has many who would sustain and not disrupt. Obviously, we know the culprits as government. We know them as the incumbents. We know them as we've already talked about
dealer network, all
the dealer network. Mm-hmm. Those who benefit from the status quo. But also, the question is, what about the lawyer? Not that they're
chasers, right?
But I mean, the legal system is set up in a way to ensure that risk is not taken, and in that sense, you know, when I do think about driverless cars, and the questions of liability will come up, and I'm that's why I wanted to talk about insurance is what would the because again, insurance reacts to this imbalance. So they'll maybe issue a policy, right, assuming that a driverless car is like a normal car, but then they get hit with enough lawsuits and they realize they're paying out too much, so they raise the premiums, and they raise them to such a degree that nobody's willing to pay.
Or will they just cancel Google your policy? I've had a few edge cases over the years where that has occurred.
Exactly.
So there you are.
So the question then of, you know, obviously car companies get hit with a lot of lawsuits because people get hurt and they have to deal with it, and that's built into the cost of every car. But what would happen if that car was driverless, and the decision process, which is even more, you know, for a lawyer, that's a wonderful gold mine, isn't it? I mean, think about the way you could argue that in court, right? You know, it was the decision made by engineers at Google, right, to kill my client.
The ball rolled out in the street and the car did not swerve and it hit the school bus and all that. Yes, yes.
Exactly. And so it did the wrong thing, and it, you know, they could argue. And if the judgment from a jury goes against, the costs are astronomical. So it's one of these things that you wonder. I just openly wonder. We'd love to have some feedback on what are the likely scenarios for how insurance will play out in this world. Because again, I go back to my youth and I ask myself, okay, if I grew up today and my options were to lease or to participate in a car sharing scheme, and there are driverless cars involved, who pays for the insurance? Is it somehow going to be distributed so that part of the fee I pay includes that? Will it go out of balance at some point because of a particular case that will set a precedent and it'll derail the whole business model? It happened in one industry that was trying to get off the ground, literally.
I think that's an excellent point. The solution might be well-capitalized in early players in driverless cars. It could be those who have incredible political sway to create new laws to address these things.
Yeah, I think Elon Musk and others who have the chutzpah to sort of say that they can change the world and then are able to actually do something about these we talked about trying to run against the windmills of the world. All good, you know, if it happens. I just worry that there are these spider webs to trap the innovators.
Well, I think it's an excellent question, because you have to say, well, could somebody like Henry Ford or Benz introduce, you know, let's say thinly capitalized, right, or maybe moderately capitalized, introduce a new product in that space, given the issues you described with insurance, among lots of other issues, let's say.
Well, this is why we go back to the first story, is that when you see the innovations that succeeded, they were actually compliant with most of the infrastructure.
Norms.
They did not try to truly disrupt in that sense of sort of tear down these walls. They were compliant, finding foothold markets that made sense, then expanded, and pretty, it was like, you know, the camel in the tent idea, that, you know, you get your nose in and slowly but surely you're inside after a while, and then you are so dominant that actually laws are made around you, not because you simply you are so important to the infrastructure of the nation, right? So you don't bulldoze or railroad people into things. You kind of just persuade through sheer
market power,
brilliance, right, power, sure, excellence, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, the market power itself, and that is a gradual, and it's a process that comes from below, and I'm trying to think of the right words and the right analogy. It's asymmetry at its core, right? It's the idea that you are unobserved as a threat, and yet you shift slowly from.
It's like a virus.
It's more like this transition from impossible to inevitable, right? So it how does that happen? And the answer is slowly, and that's where I wonder whether the patience of the technologists is long enough, you know, is strong enough to wait for some of these things to play out. That's where we're on different clock cycles, you know, as industries.
That's an interesting perspective, because I wonder if it's happening through, maybe we should consider the auto manufacturers or the distributors or the brands as operators, and perhaps their vehicles are the means in which some of these new technologies will occur, because they have the market position, and given all the regulations and all the things we've talked about, you know, in terms of why the auto industry hasn't changed a whole lot. You know, you see the new BMW SUV with self-parking. It's not new to cars necessarily, but you're seeing it on more and more cars. So there's a piece of it. And then we have these, Mercedes has these, you know, lane change warning systems and other things. And so,
well, that makes to me more sense. That makes, these are assisting us, you know, driver's assistance, right. And they make more sense to me than a purely driverless car, which sounds more like a really a moonshot. Maybe a driverless car that only works, you know, on sanctioned parts of highways where under certain conditions, that would make sense, right? That, you know, it would be like a really smart cruise control. You know, you set it and it won't crash in the car in front of you. There are such things already, but it may be a little bit more clever that it also follows some map directions, and that would work gradually, right? That you make stepwise improvement. Parking, certainly a lot of people have trouble with it, and so if you can assist the driver with parking, if you can assist the driver with maps, which we're already doing, navigation, assist with emergency situations, sense when there's a panic stop and apply the brakes in the more intelligent way and more in the optimal way, I should say, rather than the hesitation that maybe drivers have. And again, these are all things I've already seen. I know they exist. I'm just saying that bit by bit, these things will get added, and I would expect in another decade or two, because again, we're dealing with update cycles that are slow, that these things converge. And the problem with it is, in general, as a disruptive framework, it would explain that will these improvements, these technological advances, sustain and therefore keep the current incumbents
going, right? Or will they
or is this something that enables an entrant, a technologic, you know, the original definition of a disruptive technology was that the technology enabled an entrant to create a new business model around that technology and thus become or displace the incumbent. That is the question about these technologies. Is driverless car going to make Google into a car maker? My answer, typically, is no. Again, I have the same hypothesis with regard to Tesla, because, again, I ask myself, can someone else do the same thing? And yes, I'm prepared to be wrong, because there may be other factors about cycle time, like I said, about the ability of the incumbent to actually react at all. The theory suggests that incumbents do react eventually to a threat if they perceive it, and I do believe that at some point they will perceive a Tesla as a threat and react in kind. But again, maybe not. You know, I think Elon Musk believes that they're all stupid, and maybe he's right. So that's and as far as these driver's aids, I mean, again, bit by bit, they're going to come in, and I think BMW will take them and run with them. I think there might be something interesting to be done with respect to having an upgradable module, which is where computing comes in. And I've always, you know, I like the idea of having the phone and or tablet or whatever computing platform exists, have that be interchangeable, so that you know the car is not integrating a lot of the software at the factory.
The other way around, right?
Yeah,
right. Well, I think this is a good wrap to our faster horse discussion. The one analogy I might draw from our discussion is, if you look at the rise of the Windows PC over decades, you know, there were empires built on peripherals, right? If you think about what the iPhone is doing these days, or smartphones are doing these days, it's integrating a lot of that, but hopefully in a more useful way. I mean, you know, thumb authentication has been around for quite some time, as one example. Mm-hmm. But it's been an add-on, you know, and of course, Microsoft introduced Bob years ago to try to make the thing easier to use. So perhaps we might learn a little bit from what's happened in the last 20 or 30 years and apply it to cars, as you say, if they open up a bit and maybe the new technologies will grow quickly above and beyond or in that metadata layer above cars.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you believe in gradualism, if you believe in disruption as in all of its sort of corollaries, I think that we need to explore is more about this question of will the car modularize enough to allow the computer to become a module within it that's a replaceable, end user replaceable. I think that's the kind of thing that would really, I think, allow the cycle time problem to be solved. Like I said, the technology, the information technology and communications technologies are going on a very rapid cycle time, right? The car business and transportation in general goes on a very slow cycle time. And right now, this causes a lot of imbalance. And the people who are pushing from the technology side, well, they're impatient and they just want things to happen. And the car people are like, we're going as fast as we can.
Let's talk about it in 3 years, right?
Yeah, let's come back to this. But if they allow the tech to come in as a module, then the car cycle doesn't matter. In fact, it might even slow because you're happy with an upgrade of your system. Like it's like I just you upgrade to iOS 7, it feels like a new phone. Well, you upgraded your inboard computer and the software within that computer, and it feels like a new car,
right?
And you get that ability to stretch the hardware dollar, if you will. Anyway, that's, I think, the thesis here of this whole series will be how can technology people think about cars and how car people can think about technology. I think these are increasingly overlapping now.
Yes, yes. And I think finally, to close, what's the role of the operators, the people that we love to loathe, because there are deals being cut. There was an article on Audi cutting a deal with Verizon for a future set of cars. And, you know, you wonder what the implications of that are.
Yeah, I used the word in technology and telecom. And even within those two worlds, we bundle them. ICT is the kind of the buzzword, right? Information and communications technologies, now the new IT. I hear this all the time, ICT, ICT, not IT. Mm-hmm. But the C and the T are actually very different, right? Or the I and the C, I should say. The I and the C are very different because they're on different cycle times as well. So we could say ICT is information, communications, and transportation technology, ICTT. This would be three things that we're all kind of coming from different areas, converging, but fundamentally on different cycle times and therefore out of phase with each other and all kinds
different
of problems.
Different economics, all kinds of things.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Great. Good show. Thanks, Horace.
All right.